You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is the Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. Plenty of fish in the sea? Well, not always. Decades of overfishing by the global tuna industry have now pushed the final frontiers to the waters of Papua New Guinea. Now, journalist Olivia Pole's film, Canning Paradise, looks at the development of the tuna industry in Madang in Papua New Guinea, focusing in particular on the establishment of the Pacific Marine Industrial Zone, which is opposed by many of the local people. Now, I find out why there is so much opposition from Olivia, whose film will be screened this weekend at the Kuala Lumpur Eco Film Festival 2012. Welcome to Malaysia, Olivia.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, you're a journalist from France. I mean, how did you end up making films about the tuna industry in Papua New Guinea? I mean, France and PNG, they're miles apart, Olivia.
Yep, they're not that close. No, well, the story behind it is basically I was studying journalism in Sydney. I used to study history and anthropology in Paris before moving to Australia 6 years ago. And in my last year of studies, I was studying investigative journalism, and we were shown a very simple YouTube clip about Papua New Guinea and about a local man that was talking about the impact that a first tuna cannery had on his village. Mm-hmm. And the YouTube clip was had a very interesting title. It was Surviving the Cannery. And I found it really strange. I'm like, wow, this is supposed to be development? It's supposed to be a foreign cannery that comes in and creates, you know, thousands of jobs for local people. And you had that local man that was saying that his tribe was going to disappear and that all the people were actually growing impoverished. And that was the start of, you know, the project that really just started with that YouTube clip. I watched it, and then I was about to finish my studies, and I decided to pack my bags and go and explore the country. Right. And then, yeah, this is the result.
How did you fit in? Papua New Guinea isn't exactly totally developed as compared to where you were. How did you fit in?
Well, it's a very raw place, to put it this way. It's probably the most extraordinary country that I've ever been to. I've been lucky enough to have been to 35 places around the world, and this is absolutely extraordinary because you have people that actually live in a very different way that you can find in the Western world. You have a whole society that is based on communal land ownership, customary land ownership, which does not exist in our society. All development that takes place in our own societies is based on the monetization of land, private ownerships and so on, so you can build projects on that land. In PNG, you have a society where 97% of the land is believed to be owned by customary landowners. Mm-hmm. So really the rules of the game are very different here. And you have extraordinary people that have a history of 50,000 years of a connection with nature, of, you know, harvesting their gardens, of fishing in their rivers, and then accessing it to traditional markets, and then making, you know, plenty, really a full use of their land. And really a society almost self-reliant that is now seeing the impact of globalization coming with the tuna industry, but it also forestry projects, It's also mining sites and so on and so forth. So it was very interesting to me. Like, it's a rough place, yes it is, but it's also a place where you need to go, and you need, because these stories need to be told as well.
Well, in fact, I think Malaysian companies have palm oil plantations in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, they do. Mm. Yeah, Malaysian companies have palm oil plantations. They also have huge forestry projects and interest. And there is actually, at the Environmental Film Festival this week, a really good film about this, about the Malaysian interest in Vanimo. And the film is entitled Big Bella Bagarap by David Fedele, and I think you can see it on Sunday. You can check out the website.
Okay, so that's the Eco Film Fest that Olivia is talking about. I'll give you more details in a while. But Olivia, what made you want to actually come up with a film? I mean, you could have written it all out. You could have written an article. You're a journalist, right? You could have expressed that way. Why did you want to explore?
Well, first of all, I would have needed to write a really long article because these
but
issues.
But you had no experience. You're not a filmmaker as such.
No. I was just, you know, trained as a journalist, but then I had absolutely no experience in filmmaking whatsoever before starting that project. Mm-hmm. But I always thought as well that, you know, you learn all the theory at university and you actually don't go, or very rarely go onto the field. And I'm like, well, I actually want to train myself. I want to experience and see if I like it as well. And I think with the film, you know, I'm very much against the fact that these development issues are very often you have countless academic articles and economics that are going to talk about the best way of how to go about how to develop a country, but that stays in the sphere of academia, and it actually very rarely, you know, talk to the normal person. Whereas with a film, you can actually touch a much broader audience, yep. And I think it can have a much broader impact because you're actually talking to the people, normal people, you and I, you know, that are impacted by these projects.
And so, I mean, the messages sort of come out differently as well, isn't it? There's more emotion in it.
It's true. That's the trick. When you do a film, you know also that it's almost like an internal fight between the journalist and the filmmaker, because the journalist knows that you need to remain true to the story and try to get as many details as you can about the reality on the ground. But at the same time, when you do a film, especially when you want to build that bridge between a country that is so different, such as PNG, and the outside world, where all the pressures come from to go ahead with this type of development, that's a challenge. So it means that you're constantly fighting for yourself to try to simplify the story, but still need to remain true, but you bring more emotions. So as well, you're able to engage with people, and I made that film so that people could talk about these issues. Right.
Did you find that it was more fun doing the film rather than just writing an article?
I'm not sure about... No, it's great. It's great. It's extraordinary to be able to live with the people. I mean, you don't make a film about people. You make a film with people, and you stay with them. You document their lives. You document their struggle. You try to understand, figure out the mess that the country is in. And that is extraordinary. That is irreplaceable. You can do it as well as a journalist just writing. But with film as well, it's a little more sensitive because you're bringing in a camera with a lot of people that are actually not used to see a camera at all. So it's very important to have a small gear, very important as well to build this connection and work really with the people and develop some amazing relationship. I'm still in touch with, you know, a lot of people that are in my story.
And, were they happy to talk to you, the people?
It takes a while. It takes a while because the history of PNG since independence is arguably a history of exploitation. We have had two of the biggest environmental disasters in the world. You have had the Bougainville Civil War, where one of the biggest mining company in the world, Rio Tinto, was kicked out, led to a civil war of 10 years with maybe, you know, 20,000 people that died. Horrible results. Why? Because environmental legislation is basically never enforced, and you have these mining companies that can simply dump all their waste directly into the rivers. Now it's directly into the sea with a new Chinese and Australian project that I mentioned in my film as well. And yeah, it's very, like, this story of exploitation also means that when you come as a white man to this place, people are skeptical, and they are bound, and it's normal, and you have to accept the fact that, yeah, well, you know, most people that came before, they actually will run away with your resources, and you're left with very little. Mm-hmm. So, but
it's
once you build that trust, and once you go back as well, I think it's very important as well to go back, then people open up and then are really willing to help and really open, and you can have absolutely amazing stories in these countries.
So how long did it take you to come up with the whole documentary? It's called, what, Canning Paradise?
Yes, it's called Canning Paradise. It took me about 2 years on and off, because obviously I needed to fundraise, so I needed to have another job on the side just to be able to pay for all the costs that, you know, you need for a film.
So you had another job on the side while you were in PNG?
No. While I was back in Australia. Okay. I edited the film in Australia, but the longest really for that story, what took the longest is the writing. Mm-hmm. It took me about 6 to 7 months just to write that story, because I wanted it to remain as true as possible from what it is on the ground. And because it's very easy to do a black and white film about very, you know, multinational corporations that have dominated, you know, the fishing, and then now after Papua New Guinea, and have that, you know, story of exploitation. But then to understand all the dynamics that are on the ground in a society that doesn't function at all the same way as Malaysia, but we have, that's the challenge. And it took me a very long time, and to train myself how to edit as well, and then have the help of amazing editors that came on board.
In the 1950s, the world was fishing out, what, 400,000 tons of tuna. Would you know what that number is like now?
Yes, it is now more than 4 million, so it's a tenfold figure. And in the 1940s, it was probably 300,000.
Okay.
So, and why is that? It's because before it used to be just a hook and line or pull and line sort of fishing where you just target one particular fish and you don't have any bycatch. Then basically the industry built these giant boats, which are super trawlers, really. They're called purse seiners. So it's basically you attach a massive net that is going to take everything it can from the
ocean. Sweep it, yeah.
Sweep it, and you don't only catch the species that you target, such as tuna, but you also catch turtles, sharks, dolphins, a lot of other species. So you have environmentalists that would say this is the most unsustainable, you know, method of fishing. So that led to these numbers. And right now, in 2010, the UN came forward and said that if we don't change the way we are fishing and our consumption habits, well, we might have a world without fish by 2050. Mm-hmm. Now, this is extraordinary, an extraordinary thing to say, and it really shows the limits of the industrialization at any cost that we have done pretty much all around the world, and you have seen waters all around the world being plundered by the most powerful countries, such as Europe, such as countries in Southeast Asia as well, and so on.
Right. Just talking about the tuna, I was reading that 5 of the world's 8 tuna species are already classified as threatened or nearly threatened with extinction. And this is according to the red list of the threatened species compiled by the IUCN.
Yes.
Right? And the other thing is the global tuna industry is, of course, an economic juggernaut, with fishing in the Pacific Ocean alone accounting for 65% of the global commercial catch.
Absolutely.
worth about, what, $5.5 billion
yes.
a year. How much of that is actually going to waste? We don't really know, do we?
Well, how much illegal fishing is taking place is a very valid question. There are some estimates that would say that in the world you would have it would be maybe 40 billion worse, but you don't really know because it's happening at sea, and it also happens in waters of small countries that have limited capacities to actually monitor what happens in their waters. So that's that. But that's one issue. The other issue here is an issue of yes, it is a multi-billion dollar industry, but for the countries that actually own the fish, so to say, since you had the introduction of exclusive economic zones so that countries could actually claim the marine resources in their own waters. Since you have that, you have had a huge challenge for these countries because they see all the industry coming in. In the Pacific, as you said, you know, it's 2/3 of the world's tuna catches are caught
That's
in
right.
the Central and Pacific Ocean. And Papua New Guinea became recently the biggest, the place where the most fishing in the world is done, with 17% of the world's tuna catches are now in their waters, with
right.
more than 700,000 tons. But for that country, that doesn't mean having billions of dollars at all. And what happens is you have these small nations that, for a very long time, they have just been dependent on licenses and access fees. Now, licenses and access fees, the total value of the catch might be worth billions, but it is only, some estimates would say, 2% up to 8% of that value. Mm-hmm. So you get very little revenue for small nations that actually go into government coffers. And that's what's happening in PNG. So you have the National Fisheries Authority as well as the government, which says, look, we need now to tell these companies that have plundered their own waters. Filipino companies are a perfect example because they have destroyed their own waters and now they found themselves with no fish. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to actually go closer to where the last remaining fish are. And so the government wants to attract all these corporations and say, look, you're going to set up in Medang and have as much as 10 multinational corporations, fishing corporations, that can then export to Europe or the US or maybe China, as you know, there's a rising market out there.
Yeah.
That's the situation. But that said, it doesn't mean that you have any more money from it, because the ownership of these companies is always going to remain foreign. And when you have a history and you want to also set up these developments, it might sound a little bit complex, but I'll try to stay simple, within a special economic zone. Now, it's a very familiar term for Southeast Asian countries.
Yep.
It's a model that was used in China, started in China in the 1980s, end of the 70s, whereby you basically create a country within a country with its own regulations. It's all environmental and labor regulations sometimes. And to be able to open the door and say, look, we need as much foreign direct investment as possible to build a manufacturing base. And that's exactly the plan that you want to, that they want to do in PNG, and that is extremely dangerous if you actually look at what you're talking about here. You're talking about a country whereby, without special economic zones, enforcement of very basic labor rules is very difficult. And that's what I discuss in the film. You're talking about environmental regulations. I was mentioning, you know, two of the worst environmental disasters in the world that happened before, with the Okdedi mine, with Bougainville, are non-existent as well. I mean, the laws are there, but it's just the enforcement that is not there. And is it, you know, lack of political will or capacity that is something for people to see and discuss and change? And yeah, so they are very pressing concerns, because once you create a special economic zone, you basically, it's not made for the local people. The local people, they would live from fishing in the sea that is right next to their shores, right, in the lagoon. Or they would harvest their gardens. But once you attract these multinational corporations coming in, you can see that the local people, because of all these trawlers that come in, and because you got constant oil spills in the lagoon, which is one of the most biodiverse places in the world, I'm talking about Medang here, well, these people cannot fish. Now, if you alienate the land, if you steal the land from the people, as it has been done, it is a very old story. You can
watch. Because it's customary land.
Because it is the land on which the development takes place is not customary land. Okay. It is state land. And I go more in depth into this issue with the film, because it is a history of broken promises that started very early in the colonial days, when the German Catholic missionaries came to Papua New Guinea, alienated land with very presumably dodgy deals, you know, made in sign language. And then over the years, always told local people, look, we are going to run plantations, we're going to develop the land for you, but if we can't look after that land after a while, we will give it back to you. Don't worry. That never happened. And in the back of all the local people that, with overpopulation as well, you have the villages that are growing. They now need that land to be able to harvest their gardens and feed their families. They can't. And it's in their back, and without their consent and knowledge, that you actually started to invite a first company, Filipino company, and then you want to invite much more, up to 10 more. And the local people have no voices in there. And at no point did the government actually try to acknowledge the fact that these people still have a say in that piece of land. And, well, how it will end up, I don't know. But what I wanted to say, to go back to the way they live and the connection that you have. So if you can't fish and if you can't harvest your garden, you are locked in for the very first time in a cash economy system, whereby the only job that you will have is with the cannery. Now, if that cannery actually proposes substandard wages, where you can walk back home, you know, with $15 a week to feed your family, you have left your garden. You used to probably make. There are very little studies done about how important the informal economy is, but the few ones that were done would actually say that you could make 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 times the amount that you make in a formal economy. So really, people are bound to feel cheated by these developments, because the offer is really not that great. And within this SEZ, and that's what's happening also in China, for example, you are attracting people from all around the country, people that you have left out for so long and that crucially need basic services and access to education and so on. But you have left them out for so long that these are the people that are going to fill those jobs and coming in. And in PNG, when you have, in Papua New Guinea, sorry, PNG, when you have a society which is based on clans, you have 850 languages, you have different cultures, different traditions. When you have outsiders that actually come and squat on the land because they need space, you know, to be able to go to work and so on, they are adding ever more pressure on already the people that are already struggling with a small pieces of land, and you have a recipe for disaster and conflict between these people.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. When we come back, we'll find out. I'm going to play a small teaser, a short teaser.
Sure.
To the film called, documentary called Canning Paradise. And before that, Riverlex has a problem. Now he says, I'm pronouncing your name all wrong.
All right.
Olivier Paulet.
Oui, oui.
I apologize, Riverlex. I'm going to make up for that up next. next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. The Kuala Lumpur Eco Film Festival is happening this weekend, starting from the 12th all the way to the 14th of October. We spoke to the filmmakers of A Movie on the Sun Bear sometime early in the week, and that's happening on Sunday, the 14th of October. And right now I have with me Olivier Paulet. He's a journalist, he's a director, producer and narrator of the documentary called Canning Paradise, which will be screened at 4:30 p.m. this Sunday, the 14th of October. I will also tell you a little bit more about the Eco Film Fest, where it's actually happening and, you know, the works. But before I actually move on, I'm going to play a quick trailer, the audio from the trailer that you've actually put forth, Olivier.
Yep, sure.
Just north of Australia lays the land of the unexpected, Papua New Guinea, a country largely ignored by Western media. The beauty of the natural environment and the friendliness of the local people make you feel very privileged to be here. It doesn't take long before you feel pretty much in paradise. For these populations, fishing, hunting, and gardening have been the foundation of life for thousands of years.
Se estima que la producción de atún se elevará finalmente a 400.000 toneladas al año, dirigidas al mercado europeo que consume actualmente un total de unas 710.000.
Your right to freedom of speech is presently suspended by the Supreme Court reference.
The government, the World Bank and all other agencies, they are trying as much as possible to get land from the people.
You're developing a whole town, a satellite town.
Place where we used to rely on to make gardens and now being occupied.
This is one of the fastest success stories promoted by international institutions. A story of cities transformed into processing hubs. A story of people in search of a better life.
Our
people expect us to deliver some real developments.
No, marine park. Resource no timber. Resource no timber. Mining come
up. It's hard to live because it will destroy everything. Our reef, our fishing ground.
We will also face the dilemma of having development at any cost. At any cost.
Despla Island before. Despla Island and become a paradise.
You know, Olivia, Olivier.
Oui.
You know, when I was listening to that, the people of Papua New Guinea, of course, are the ones on the losing end. But how are they actually fighting this? I mean, do they have the right people who are championing the cause? Do they have the people with the? Are they on the same page? Are they being exploited all over again? You know,
this is one of the main challenges. You do have some very vocal opposition to that project, but you need to understand as well that in PNG, because society is built in such a way that you're always looking after your clan interests, your clans. So it's actually very difficult to reach a consensus, even though people might feel cheated on one side of, you know, the arbor, let's say. You go to the other side, and these other people are going to be cheated as well, but they won't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But you do see now some people that are organizing, and but again, in Papua New Guinea, the problem here is that systematically, instead of trying to educate their own people, the government is coming in and just saying, look, this development will happen regardless of what you think, instead of actually trying to impose the dialogue. And systematically what you have, and it's the same for mining projects, forestry projects, and so on, it is just go to court. And that's what's happening now. Mm. You have a really big court case, which should take place now in October, an injunction against this whole project, because, and in the injunction, they actually the lawyer actually argues that there is absolutely no knowledge whatsoever and no efforts made by the government to actually explain to the local people. There is a lack of consent and a lack of information, which is extraordinary, and which is something that I've documented myself, and a lack of knowledge that is not just at for the local people, it's also at government levels, where you have government departments that are not talking to each other. And when you have a whole project that started without any of the basic studies done, without any environmental impact statement at first, without very much waited for social impact study, special economic zone laws that still haven't been voted, so you really bulldozed this project without any of this framework in place. And when you don't talk to the people, you are really bound to feel cheated, and you have absolutely no idea what's coming on your lap. And the most worrying sign is the fact that in power, the people that are supposed to be leaders, that are supposed to be the most educated man, that received, you know, great education in Australia or elsewhere, would tell you, well, I don't really understand that project. And when you have, you know, and I'm talking about the ex-governor of the province, the man that, you know, was just sitting in that chair, looking at his development taking place, could have said, look, you know, there's so much to do, and I myself do not understand. Mm-hmm. That is quite worrying in itself. And how can local people actually understand if even their leaders do not?
Exactly. Mm. Do you see a way out of all
and
of this?
Yeah, to go back to the fighting, I want to say also that the body which is now writing special economic zones law for PNG, for a sovereign country, is the International Finance Corporation. Mm-hmm. Now, the International Finance Corporation is a private arm of the World Bank. That's very interesting. They're also writing the SEZ laws for Indonesia and so on, because they are typically a body which is obviously going to look after private interests, because that's what they were created for. But we all know the history of the World Bank and structural adjustment programs in the 1990s, and how you have found countries where it were countries that have really grown impoverished with the privatization of all basic services and so on. So you have basically the exact same people that are now writing these sovereign laws for a country, and that's worrying in itself. And for the very first time in their history, they do have an ombudsman commission. The World Bank does have a body like that. It's called CAO. And there's been the very first formal complaint against the government lodged by the people of Medang, more than 300 people. I think 300. Against their own government. And now the World Bank is apparently making a sort of workshop right now, so they try to bring in the local people to talk to the government and try to facilitate a dialogue. There's so much more to be done. So these are the ways to fight. But I mean, if every single time you have so-called development that comes and people tell you, look, just take it to the courts if you're not happy, that's really not the way to go. But unfortunately, that's the way it functions there. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
that sounds really familiar, to be honest. Mm. Is there what about violence when a community is deprived of basic needs? Often that sort of leads to violence.
Yes.
Do you see much of that happening in PNG because of all this development?
Yes, absolutely. Well, you have a lot of disillusioned young people that are now saying, look, these issues have been going on for, well, the land issues has been going on for 100 years. These development issues have been going on for 15 years. The battle for the land, at the very least 50 to 60 years, we actually tried in the 1950s and 1960s to fight it to the courts. And what do you tell these people when nothing has changed? Nothing has changed, and when they look at the very first company that arrived, it actually made their life worse. And now they're promising 10 more, with obviously all these promises are really based on a worldview that, look, we have a really poor country here. We have Papua New Guinea. These people are so poor, right? They live 40%, maybe, I don't know the number, 40% of people live under a dollar a day. So they need employment. We need to create this industrial base. We need to replicate exactly what has been done in China or in the Philippines. But that's really not taking into consideration the fact that society has nothing to do with it. You have people that have a lot of people that are self-sustainable. And again, to go back to what I said before, through access to informal markets and a traditional economy, can make much more than 12 hours on the processing lines, you know.
Yep.
Every day.
And
Yeah, so is there a way out of this? Yeah, I hope so. That's why I make a film.
I mean,
and
you,
that's why, yeah.
That's right. You were an outsider going to PNG to investigate an internal struggle. And you did say initially the people weren't, it's a trust issue, right?
Yes.
Did it take you a long time to gain their trust and then start to get them to talk to you?
I would say a couple of weeks. A couple of weeks, and I had great contacts there as well. I could liaise with a lot of students from a local university out there, and that really helped me out tremendously, you know, to accommodate myself as well with the country, with the customs, with the way people live. And but once people actually say that you're not here to rip them off, as it has been, you know, so many times before, they are very, very helpful, and they really open the doors to you, and they're like, look, you know, but even though it is not an easy place to do these sort of things, because as I go back to what I was saying before, because you do have some real conflict between people that disagree, some people that still believe in the promise of progress and money, because money is, you know, the word is used everywhere, just saying, oh, you're going to make plenty of money, plenty of money. 10 years later, you see that you haven't made any money. Mm-hmm. And even the people that I interviewed that were in support of the project, and some of them I decided not to actually include them in my film. I just read the newspaper last week. They're actually now against the project because they've been ripped off and they haven't made a cent out of it.
Okay.
So,
do you have a conclusion to the film? Are there resolutions that you present at the end of the film?
Well, I made that film to actually have a debate so that people can start talking about these issues, the free trade game, you know, why is there so many, you know, raw resources that are sourced from developing nations shipped into the biggest markets, and can't we actually shift it around and have other models of development that would be more inclusive for the local people? With, instead of trading halfway around the world, can't you have like a smaller industry that would actually serve and be localized? That would make more sense if you look at the Pacific, for example. But so I really made that film for that, to have a debate and to also have audiences that engage in that, because I really strongly believe that it's through conversations that you can solve those things and action afterwards. But well, I hope, you know, the European Union has, you know, supported that project for a very long time, because they are the ones that have actually sort of forced Fiji and PNG to sign a free trade agreement, an economic partnership agreement. They are doing that with every single African, Pacific and Caribbean countries, trying to say, look, you know, now that we're in a world where most of these countries are members of the World Trade Organization, the World Trade Organization's view on the world is that every country should be equal in terms of trade. So you shouldn't discriminate in terms of trade, regardless of how developed you are or not.
Yep.
And so these new EPAs are exactly that. You're asking smaller countries to have reciprocal agreements and to open up the borders for European interests. Now, that's interesting in itself. And what happened with the fishing industry is that only PNG and Fiji signed. Why? Because they had the tuna industry that were accessing the European market, and if they wouldn't have signed, then they would have faced tariffs of up to 24%. Mm. Now, the same, there was a sugar crisis in Fiji, exactly the same situation. And now you find PNG, like the European, has been so supportive of this project, giving not only quota and duty-free access for the fish that is fished out by foreigners, packed by foreign control companies, but packed by Papua New Guineans, then exported to the EU. They also gave a derogation on the rules of origin. Now, it's a little bit technical. I don't want to get too technical here, but that means that fish sourced from anywhere in the world can actually, and processed in PNG, can qualify for the European market. Now, that's a huge advantage, and that's why you have so many Southeast Asian companies that are eyeing at PNG and saying, oh, okay, we need to go and invest and get our fish there.
Right.
And the PNG government is trying to say, look, if you want to get our fish, and they are doing some good efforts in terms of trying to manage the resource most sustainably and trying to control the stocks, that has to be lauded. But The whole dynamics here, setting a very strange path for local people.
Mm-hmm. And the Canning Paradise is screening this Sunday, as I mentioned earlier, at 4:30 p.m. At the Dataran Tunku Chancellor Experimental Theatre in University of Malaya. Now, what do you want the audience to observe from the film? What sort of dialogue will you be having with the audience after the show?
Well, the dialogues that they want to have, really. I think a lot of people react very differently to this type of films, and people might, question really the free trade model, and that's good, especially for young people that, haven't heard what is an economic partnership agreement, and they can go, oh, I want to learn more. You have people that also could look and maybe think about, should the world really be a uniform place where every single country needs to have an industrial base and need to export to, distant markets and build their way out of poverty this way, because that's the worldview we're talking about here. Couldn't there be other solutions? Mm-hmm. And that's good. And I think the answer comes as much from the public as it comes from a film. A film is just a platform that allows you to engage with these issues and then talk about it and go back home and say, look, maybe this film talked about PNG, but maybe it's actually very relevant to indigenous people here and the way their farmland has been alienated. I don't know much about Malaysia, but that's something, that they can engage.
Where else has Canning Paradise actually screened?
Well, so far it has screened in Africa, in Ghana. It has screened in the EU, in Slovenia, in London. And now we're looking at screening it in Australia as well.
They let you screen it in the EU?
Yeah, like in festivals. But I'm working on it now. This project is not done yet. I haven't finished because I'm actually going to publish all the research behind the film on an online platform, and once I've done that, I can really look at go to the EU and see if I can show that film to parliamentarians so that they can understand the sort of consequences that these decisions that are taken in big buildings in Brussels have on the other side of the planet for little people, the people that are hugely impacted by these issues.
I mean, you're very brave, I have to say.
Well, thank you.
Are you not afraid that, someone could, take this all the wrong way?
Look, no, I don't think so. I think...
And higher powers. I'm talking about higher powers here.
Yeah, well, I think, I'm not a violent man. And I think, you can always have civilized conversations with people. Even though you're talking about exploitation, you're talking about very hard stories, these stories need to be told, and if no one tells them, then you're just keeping a status quo. So, and I mean, it's one thing for a filmmaker to go there, do his film, then take it back and then show it to a different festival. It's another thing to be on the ground and not having any sort of mean to be able to have contacts to the outside world and try to explain what's going on. So I think, the struggle is not really my struggle, it's the struggle of these people, and that's why I wanted, in the film really gives a significant amount of airtime to these people that, you very rarely hear the voices on mainstream media.
Sure. Do you think at some stage you would actually put it online for everyone to just watch it?
I will see. I just signed with a distributor in Australia that is going to help me out, put it around. And we're considering online platforms for sure. The problem is, for example, getting the film seen in Papua New Guinea, that's very difficult because people do not have access to internet, limited televisions. What do? You have made something on a medium that is quite actually difficult. So that's
But
why
language would be a barrier as well.
Language?
Do they all speak English?
No, but the film... most people would understand it. A lot of the film is actually in local language as well.
Okay.
So it's subtitled in English and So that wouldn't be an issue at all.
No. What are you going to be up to after this? After the movie?
Well, I've got a couple of ideas. I've got an Australian project that is being developed with an academic from the University of Sydney, looking at the building of national identity through the relationship with the other, with the relationship that Australia has maintained with its islands offshore, where they do processing centres for refugees, for example, which is a very controversial thing in Australia that
even
you might
here.
Have heard here.
Yes, we have.
And also is the internal displacement that happened of Aboriginal people on land. And so we're looking at, you know, going up there and do a research trip probably early next year.
Fantastic.
And that's one idea. And then my heart also lies in the Pacific, and I want to go back there and do presumably a bigger story than the one I've done here. Mm-hmm. And I think there's much to learn from the Pacific rather than teach. You have 50,000 years old cultures here, traditional knowledge. You have a model of society where, at the very, yes, people are cash poor, but you do not have homelessness. You do not have all the sins that you, I mean, problems that you can find in big cities here. You rarely see them out there. The only places where you see them is exactly the cities that are being built and where you start having, you know, all these settlers coming in and all these settlements, the shanty towns that start to develop. There are no jobs. And I want to sort of maybe reverse that, so that instead of actually looking at a country and trying to teach this country, oh, you need to develop this way, because that's the traditional way, that's how we do it all around the world. Maybe I'm optimistic, you know, working along those lines. I'm still writing it, so.
Good stuff. Anyway, you can catch Canning Paradise and many other films at the Kuala Lumpur Eco Film Festival 2012. It's happening from the 12th to the 14th of October at the University of Malaya. Just to bear in mind, Canning Paradise is screening on Sunday, the 14th at 4:30 p.m. The films will be screening at the Experimental Theatre, and other events for the festival will be held at the fairground of Dataran Tunku Chancellor. So for the full schedule of events and screenings, you can visit ecofilmfest.my. And if you'd like to find out more about Canning Paradise, do visit canningparadise.com, or you can log on to the Facebook page.
Yes, the website canningparadise.com will probably be online in 2 or 3 weeks, like when I get back to Australia, because that's where I will publish all my research.
Sure. And so the Facebook
page? They can still go on the Facebook page. So there are updates about where there are film screenings organized and so on.
That's facebook.com/Canning Paradise.
Absolutely.
It was a pleasure having you on, Olivier.
My pleasure.
I'm going to pronounce that correctly now. Yeah. Olivier Paulet, a journalist, director, producer and narrator of the documentary called Canning Paradise on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.